we're going to open an informational meeting on the 2017 report to the legislature from the Oregon Global Warming Commission. I'll invite Angus Duncan and Jessica Shipley forward. And like last time, you agreed to 5 minutes?
5 minutes.
Welcome.
Start everything with a joke. Good idea. Mr. Chairman, good afternoon. My name is Angus Duncan. I'm chairman of the Oregon Global Warming Commission. In my day job, I am president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation in Portland. And with me is Jessica Shipley from the Oregon Department of Energy, who staffs the commission and is responsible for most of the good work you will see here today. I was able to go over at least some of the commission findings last week when we were able to talk a little bit about the transportation findings, and so I'm going to not linger on those today. Although obviously, if there are questions, yeah, I'm happy to respond to them. We'll go through those data fairly quickly. I do just want to make two preliminary comments about this report, because it's different from earlier ones that we have provided you. It's different in the first case because you're receiving the 2017 report at the beginning of the session, when we hope those findings will be useful to you in making your judgment calls about legislation coming in front of you, rather than delivering it at the end of the session, when the findings are frankly pretty meaningless, because they'll be outdated before you come back into session. That's the first innovation. We hope to maintain that going forward. The second is that we're now working on the basis of data, at least in the transportation and utility sectors, that at best will be not more than 6 months old. So we hope to have, for example, the 2016 data in both of those instances by the middle of 2017. But we do operate off of 2015 data in this report, and that's a huge improvement over where this whole process started back in 2003, 2004, when we were working off late 1990s data, and we didn't even realize at that point that we had peaked in our emissions in 1999. We thought they were still going up, and that at least lent an extra urgency to the process back then, but also a misunderstanding about what our circumstances truly were. So a lot of credit goes to Jessica and to the staff at DEQ as well for really laboring to bring the data collection and processing up to date, so that you and we collectively have meaningful data from which to operate. And that, as you will see, is especially pertinent this year because of some of the transportation findings that some of you have seen already. So I want to start, if I can, with the four recommendations that you're receiving from the commission, and I'm going to spare you my reading of these, but I do want to underscore that in the first instance, we are strongly underlining the importance of a clean transportation component to any transportation bill that the legislature is able to move forward this spring. And in the second instance, this is where we're pulling a rock out of your backpack. If anyone feels an urgent need to legislate with respect to carbon in the forest, we are strongly encouraging that you not do so until the commission and the task force that we have put together is able to complete its work on forest carbon accounting, which, as you will see, is pretty groundbreaking work, and even the initial findings we've come up with so far are pretty interesting and compelling findings. Obviously, your call, what you do and what you don't do, but we do hope that that the next time you pick up the question of carbon in the forest, that you will have a significant advantage over any other legislature who's dealing with this issue, in that you'll know what's there and how it's moving about. The third and fourth recommendations go to the functioning and functionality of this commission and the ability of the state to proceed in a systematic and analytical way in figuring out what the state's climate and greenhouse gas strategies and agenda ought to be. It's not that we're doing dumb things or bad things. It's just that we're not doing things in an optimized way, either operationally or on a cost basis. So tell me I didn't. There we go. Okay, so I would like to go over these six items with you today. These are the six sort of major areas that the report addressed. And I'm asking Jessica, since she did all of the heavy lifting on inventory, to go first. And I'll just click your clicker when you tell me to. Okay?
Okay, great. Chair Hill, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jessica Shipley with the Oregon Department of Energy. One of our roles at the department is to provide the commission with technical support. So in that capacity, I'm here today to talk to you about the updated greenhouse gas inventory for Oregon and also our updated greenhouse gas emission projection. Angus changed the colors on me, so I'm going to have to look at the slides while we go. But so this slide is showing you our updated inventory from 1990 through 2015. As Angus mentioned, the data points that are new in this report are 2014 and 2015. The others are the same data that we had previously. Angus noted already that Oregon's emissions peaked in 1999, which was several years before the U.S. as a whole. We had another mini peak in 2007 and then several years of declining emissions and then flat emissions in 2012 and 2013 and 2014, followed by a noticeable uptick in 2015. That's about a 5% year-over-year increase in emissions from 2014 to 2015. And that increase, the majority of it is due to transportation sector emissions. The rest of the increase is sort of split evenly between the industrial, residential, and commercial sectors. Okay. And so this slide is just another way we can slice and dice up the data that we have on Oregon's emissions. So this is showing you a snapshot of 2015 emissions. And we've just broken out the data slightly differently here. So this shows you that transportation was responsible for 37% of Oregon's emissions in 2015, followed by electricity use as the second largest, natural gas use as the third largest. And what's left over in the residential and commercial and industrial sectors are just other fuels used on site, high global warming potential gases, landfills, other things like that are left in those pizza slices. So this is the one I have to look at.
Representative Johnson has a question.
Okay.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. Getting back to the transportation question, and I missed Angus's 5-minute report in the last meeting, so I just wanted to quickly ask a question.
Never see another 5-minute report from me.
Regarding transportation, what's the metric for measuring the increase? Is it vehicles on the road, vehicles licensed, registered? What's your metric? You obviously don't have devices hooked up to every tailpipe to measure emissions, correct?
Right, yes. Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson. The transportation sector emissions are reported by fuel suppliers that bring fuel into the state of Oregon, so that's how we track it. It's tracked by different type of fuel.
And you're assuming correct?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. And we could actually, if you wanted to, just jump ahead to those metrics. All right, we'll get to them then.
Stick with your foil.
I only have one more.
Go ahead.
Okay, so this slide, in the yellow line, you're seeing the same historical emissions data from the two slides ago, our greenhouse gas inventory from 1990, except now we've added to it our new projection of greenhouse gas emissions going forward into the future, and that's that top red line that you now see has sort of a drop in 2030, and that's representing our expected anticipated effect from the Senate Bill 1547 policies passed last session. And we're showing that alongside our previous projection. So that's that sort of whitish cream colored line on the top there. That's the projection we had in our previous report. So that's just to give you a context for where we were projecting we were going previously and to compare it to sort of the effect of that bill that passed last session. And both of those are shown alongside also the linear trajectory to Oregon's greenhouse gas reduction goals in 2020 and 2050. So kind of the key takeaways here, we're projecting about a 10 million metric ton gap in 2020 between our projected emissions and our statewide goal, and about a 44 million metric ton gap in 2050 with current existing policy.
And I think the important dynamic to understand here, the reason those lines, when we project them out, tend to go sideways, is that there are a couple of forces that are tending to drive them up. Economic growth tends to drive them up, although not as one-to-one a basis as used to be the case. And population tends to drive emissions up. The two things that can drive emissions down are technology and policy. And so those four forces are always, we project them, when we project forward, we project them in an equilibrium, offsetting each other, until and unless we have either technology or policy, that makes a significant difference in the lines. And 1547 is, in a sense, both technology-driven and policy-driven. And that's kind of where I want to get to next. I want to just review in a little bit of a backcasting and forecasting way, where we are on the electricity sector. Mindful that between the utilities, electric and gas, utilities and transportation, we're dealing with about 80% of the state's greenhouse gas emissions. So that's where our initial focus in all cases needs to be and has been. We have to get to the other things as well, but first things first. And I guess I want to emphasize here, as we are going through the process analyzing and trying to bring about a reduction in utility emissions, we are appropriately constrained both by the need for the utility system to be able to provide reliable power and for the utility system to avoid particularly price spikes that unnerve both households and businesses, and we know how unnerving that can be because we've gone through some spates of extreme spikes in the electrical sector in recent memory, and they are terribly disruptive. So we're trying to walk our way through what's the right mix of policy and technology that will bring emissions down. The Boardman decision, which was a negotiated decision that in the end was ratified by the Public Utility Commission. The negotiations that led to Senate Bill 1547 in the last session, both were circumstances where a number of stakeholders, including myself and the two utilities and some of the customers would sit down and try to work through what was an appropriate way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, while managing for costs and in managing for disruption. And in both of those cases, folks came to a negotiated understanding, not something that everybody agreed to, but something that most people agreed to, and that the utilities and the Public Utility Commission both are committed to making work. And we expect those will have a significant impact on greenhouse gas emissions from the utilities, but the issues that are still to be worked through with PacifiCorp have to do with whether they wait until 2030 to end coal service from their coal plants outside the state of Oregon, or whether those coal plants close earlier than that. And frankly, our expectation is that a number of them will close earlier, that Pacific wanted the flexibility of a deadline as far out as 2030, but that basically gives them the opportunity to try to manage the exit of what are often superannuated coal plants and a gravitation to the next mix renewable thermal and efficiency resources. PGE is a trickier problem because their Boardman plant is scheduled to end coal combustion at the end of 2020. And they're also losing some energy and capacity resources they had owned on contract from the Mid-Columbia PUDs. So they've got a hole that they have to backfill. And they're going through an integrated resource planning process right now in which they have basically come up with two different approaches, one of which involves a large baseload gas plant and the other of which does not. Both of them meet their reliability criteria. In both cases, the costs are essentially aligned and very close to each other. So there's a lot of question, I think, about how PGE and the Public Utility Commission resolve those the remaining questions and whether we end up with significant new gas capacity, which will tend to drive the emissions up, or whether there are alternatives that will allow PGE's emissions to continue to go down. This is approximately what we project for the two utilities combined. We didn't project them. They projected these in their own IRPs. And as you see, pre-Senate Bill 1547, while our target was going down, that's the green line, their emissions were essentially going sideways. You know, their resources were getting more efficient, but the loads were growing. And again, those two things tended to offset each other. And we were making no progress on reducing emissions in the utility sector. Under 1547, you know, they still are running above the line through about 2030, and when we hit 2030, and the coal plants exit the portfolio, you know, the emissions drop dramatically. Even more important than that, because of the renewable portfolio standard requirement to reach 50%. New renewable resources by 2040, you know, there is a very real opportunity for those emissions not just to go down in 2030, but to stay down, and to stay down in ways that maintain reliability standards and manage costs. And I will just observe parenthetically that one of the real phenomena of just the last 8 to 10 years has been the rapid drop in the installed cost of wind and solar generation, and slightly after that, but an equally dramatic drop in the cost of battery storage technologies. And those three issues combined argue for utilities finding ways to take advantage of those, you know, both the declining cost curves and the opportunities that they present for keeping those emissions trajectories going downhill. And we think there's a real opportunity for Oregon and for the U.S. generally to head in that direction. By all of the nationwide analyses that I've seen, it appears that, you know, whatever the current administration does with President Obama's Clean Power Plan, you know, chances are it will be largely complied with on a nationwide basis, you know, even if there are a number of states who decline to comply with it at all, simply because the economics and the technology are now driving emissions down, not policy.
Angus,
Rip.
Vance has a question.
Thank you, and thanks for all the work on this. I was reading somewhere about the challenge when it comes to green power, not to the lower cost generation, which seems to be happening, but the fact that battery piece that you talked about was still in its infancy when it comes to the sheer volume of storage necessary to avoid the need to build back up gas plants, just which of course raises costs significantly of the green, so-called green power. When do you anticipate we'll have battery technology such that we don't have to back up every solar farm with a gas-fired plant?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bentz, if you had asked me that 5 years ago, the general consensus in the industry, which at that time was looking at about a $350 a megawatt hour cost of capacity in those batteries was it would be at least 10 years before they they were able to cut that in half. It's now 5 years later, and they have already cut that in half. The batteries that are going into the new Chevy Volt are going in at somewhere between $140 and $150 a megawatt or a kilowatt hour, which is significantly better than a 50% reduction in the price, and that's before the really substantial economies of volume, you know, have started to be captured in places such as the Tesla battery factory that is going into Nevada. So I don't want to overstate the trend lines because the last dollars are always harder to push down than the first dollars. And the point you make about having not just the cost down but the capacity up is a real material limitation. So, you know, if I'm a utility right now and I have to have firm energy and capacity, I do not rely on battery technology. It's simply not ready yet. But if I don't need it for 5 years, then I think really seriously about the value of buying a capacity product on the market and waiting for 5 years and seeing whether I have a different set of choices. Well, I absolutely will have a different set of choices. Will the costs have come down enough? Will the volumes have come up enough that in 5 years, you know, you can contemplate battery storage instead of a gas power plant? Don't know, but that's at least where the trend lines are headed.
Follow up. Thank you. So I understand that the sheer volume of solar power, for example, right now is going to result in and already has resulted in the import of solar energy from California back to Oregon because of the massive amounts of solar available during the day and, then of course, not too much at night. The question would suggest that we are overbuilding our green in anticipation of storage that may or may not show up. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bentz, I think that is a fair way to represent the risk, at least in the state of California. You know, the California solar curves in particular are driving much faster than solar curves anywhere else in the country. And that's particularly true because their diurnal peaks tend to come in the middle of the day when there's more solar energy. So they're using most of that solar energy at the peak. It's in the off-peak hours where they have excess solar energy and they need to find a place to put it or turn those panels off. And of course, if they turn the panels off, then the economics suffer. So yeah, in California, they are pushing the envelope pretty hard without having the storage technology yet. That's not the case here in the Northwest. It is certainly something I think to be cautious about.
Thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thanks, Angus. And looking at these statistics, looking at Pacific Core and PGE in terms of emissions, is there any emissions attributable to the BPA system or from other consumer owns that are they in this data?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holvey, no, they are not. They're obviously not in Pacific Core and PGE data. When we do statewide data, we would include the consumer-owned utilities in the state of Oregon, but they're almost entirely served by hydropower, either their own or Bonneville's, and so it's a very negligible additional amount of emissions. And the Bonneville system as a whole has very small emissions. So, as a practical matter, you know, you can assume that they're not having an effect on the curves.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, forgive me.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you. The reason, forgive me for this disjointed approach to this question, but it seems to me that there's a real challenge when we run out of the balancing capacity that's currently afforded to us by the BPA dams to take up the slack when the sun goes down or when the wind isn't blowing. And when that is gone, then you have to build in order to balance that without storage, you got to build natural gas. And people aren't going to be wildly excited about it if they can see that that business is going to be taken away from them, those 20-year AMs on those $500 million plants, or whatever they cost, when they see that it might all disappear because of the advent of a battery. Mm-hmm. So must put a lot of pressure on people trying to figure out how to lock in the returns for the 20 years generally necessary in these large things called utilities.
Mr. Chairman,
have you been encountering that kind of? Yeah, I'm sure you have.
Sure, Representative Bence. It is a complicated system, as you know, and you've barely scratched the surface of some of the complications that are introduced when you bring new resources in. I would add to this the fact that you need not just capacity to make sure you can toast your toast in the morning. You also need capacity on the system to maintain voltage support and other power quality considerations, and you need to have that space out around the system. And some of that you can certainly do with renewables, but some of it you will have to have dispatchable generation. Now, you can dispatch from storage as easily as you can from a fossil fuel generator if you've got the storage. I mean, that's the whole point to storage, is that you can call it up when you need it. We're simply not at a point right now where there's a lot of clarity about what combination of resources is going to be optimum, and in many ways, we are probably moving into a world in which it looks a lot more like a large securities market rather than a system where one utility manages a dozen very large resources and some small ones and is kind of sitting up on the bridge and in command of it all. This is not going to be a command and control utility system in another 10 or 15 years, it is going to look a lot more like a marketplace where there's buying and selling on a, on a year ahead, month ahead, day ahead, hour ahead basis. And in many ways, we're doing a lot of that already. Bonneville has announced that it's going to be able to do, sub-minute management of the system so that it's easier to figure out which resources you bring in to optimize for cost and power quality and so on. But it's going to be a more complicated system than it has been. It's almost certainly going to have fossil fuel thermal resources as a part of the mix, but it's going to have a lot more renewables as well, and the fossil fuel resources are going to be much more used as integrating resources than they are as baseload. And the distinction, not to insult anybody's intelligence here, but baseload is what you crank on to meet the load you know you have sort of hour in and hour out during the day. And integrating is what you use to fill in the peaks and valleys when you've got wind and solar, and they're coming up and down in ways that you don't directly control from your dispatch center. So that's what the future is almost certainly going to look like. I mean, I was having breakfast this morning with some folks from Portland General, and we spent a few minutes sort of blue skying about what it was going to look like in 10 or 15 years, and there was a remarkable amount of agreement about that. They probably put a little bit more gas in their system, and I was a little more sanguine about the storage, but we agreed that it's going to be a mix of renewables, storage, gas, hydro, capacity, energy, and a market that basically clears for all of these resources and all of the bids from each one of them. It's going to unnerve a lot of owners of resources inside and outside utilities, but it also is going to end up, I think, producing a long-term, a more efficient, more cost-efficient, and more resource-efficient system. That's what markets at their best do. Yes, sir. I'm moving on.
Good. We have about another half an hour for you. So these are
what Pacific Core's numbers look like going forward. This is what Portland General's numbers look like going forward. They're different, and they're an issue. Essentially, when they take out Boardman, they get a drop, and if they simply buy a gas plant, then their emissions start going back up again. When they drop out Colstrip in 2030 or 2035, their emissions come back to the trajectory, and then they immediately go back up again. And that's what happens when we make assumptions about a substantial amount of baseload gas staying in the system. I almost entirely discount those numbers after 2030 or 35, because who knows what the world's going to look like out then. But it's unlikely to have a lot of baseload gas in it anyway. It's the numbers between 2020 and 2035 that I think have us really concerned about what's going to happen to greenhouse gas emissions in the utility sector. Transportation emissions. So I've already kind of disclosed the punchline here. But I will just observe that when we're looking at clean transportation strategies, we're basically looking at transit, at electric vehicles, and that a lot of other stuff. And the other stuff is really important, but it's extended service and accessibility in our transit systems, so that people who don't need or want to drive have a meaningful alternative. That's especially important for low-income households. And for those who do need or want to drive, that they have the option of driving something that is very low greenhouse gas emissions and is also cost competitive with an internal combustion engine. And we're already seeing that now. The Chevy Bolt in particular, which right now is only available in Oregon and California, but they're going nationwide shortly, has a range of over 200 miles on a single charge. And the cost is in the mid-30,000s, which is about what I paid for my car, the last car I bought. And we expect those costs to come down, particularly as battery costs continue to come down. So transit and electric vehicles, just lock those into your brain. These are the same kinds of numbers that Jessica already showed you for the overall emissions in Oregon. But as you can see, it is the transportation emissions of the last 2 years that are starting to go up. And we know what the reasons for them going up are. Here's one of them. Vehicle miles traveled in Oregon has been going up since 2010. And that's to be expected because the economy has gotten better after the recession. And when the economy gets better, gasoline prices stay low. People feel more comfortable both driving more and driving bigger. And this is the other reason. And that is that the two vehicle sectors that are showing the most growth out there are electric vehicles and SUVs. Electric vehicles actually went up 30% last year, but that means that they occupied a 0.82% market share among new vehicle sales last year. SUVs only went up about 14% last year, but that means they went up from 50 million vehicles to 60, I'm sorry, from I think 8.5 million vehicles to 11 million vehicles, or they went up from 50% of new vehicle sales to 65% of new car sales. Short answer, you know, we're putting a lot more vehicles out on the road that use a lot more a lot more gasoline or diesel.
Representative Johnson.
Quick question. Are you referring to national numbers if you're talking millions of vehicles here?
Yes, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
How does that pertain to Oregon if we're worried about Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions?
Yeah. Representative Johnson, the VMT numbers were Oregon. I searched for Oregon vehicle sales numbers and just frankly couldn't find them. I mean, they may be available, but I don't think they're available yet. So national numbers are the best I could do. But
could I comment?
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The number in Oregon is a bit higher on EV sales, but I have no idea what it is on SUVs. My anecdotal experience watching new cars go past me on the freeway is that there are quite a lot of them.
Yeah, I would be surprised if our numbers are dramatically different from the national numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you. Forest carbon accounting.
You're calling, just threw him under the bus.
This is something 7 years ago when the commission did its roadmap. I'm sorry, do you have another question?
Representative Brock Smith.
Thank you, and I apologize before we move on. What is the total emissions as far as transportation emissions in Oregon compared to other states in our nation?
The total emissions are around 20 million tons. The emissions in other states are going to vary dramatically, mostly with the size and the population. I think probably on a per capita basis, they are not going to vary hugely. The things that will tend to drive vehicle miles traveled up will be, again, be, wealthier versus less wealthy states, but also rural versus urban states. Both of those will tend to act on the number of vehicles, the VMT, and therefore the emissions. But I think our per capita emissions are probably at or a little above the national average. But we can find that out for you, Representative Smith.
Thank you very much.
And we'll get back to you in the committee on that question. That's a good question to ask.
Good.
Okay. So forest carbon accounting. As I said, 7 years ago when we did our roadmap, we basically punted on this question. We knew there was a lot of carbon involved in forests in Oregon, but we didn't know how much, and we didn't have data that would tell us how much. So in the end, what we collectively said, and this was a task force that included industry and in the environmental community and the Forest Service and state foresters, and we basically said, look, going forward, we think that the West Side forests are accruing carbon, and we should just leave them largely alone to do so. We think that the East Side forests, public forests in both cases, while they may be accruing carbon, they also have much bigger forest health issues, and so they need to be managed more actively to try to recover forest health on the East Side before they are managed primarily for carbon acquisition. And we said we think most of the wood product that comes out of Oregon should come out of the private forest, and that they should be managed largely for product. And that was kind of a very rough gentleman's agreement until we had some data. And then we went off and had to do a lot of other work on a lot of other subjects. But last year, we decided to pick this question back up again. We impaneled another task force of academic and agency and industry experts to sit down with us and work through what we thought we had and what kind of information we needed, because we were pretty sure that, and we were hearing about issues about pulling more product or less product out. We were certainly hearing questions about forest biomass to energy. And before those questions got to where they represented the potential for a fixed battle between the environmental communities and the forest communities and the industry, we thought we at least ought to try to get a handle on the numbers. And so we have at least taken the first steps toward doing that. We know, for example, that there are about 11 billion tons of carbon dioxide equivalent in Oregon forests. So you think our entire carbon emissions in this state total about 60 million tons, but in our forests, we've got wrapped up about 11 billion tons. It's a lot of carbon. That also implies that there is a dynamic, that we are either gaining or losing carbon, and if we're gaining or losing it from a base of 11 billion tons, then potentially we're gaining or losing a lot of it. And we ought to really understand it and understand how we're losing it and or gaining it, and what we want to do more of and what we want to do less of. So we put together this task force, and we asked in particular the Forest Service, since they have the most timberland and the best access to data, to come back and tell us what they could tell us. And these are data that are based on actual transepts that are walked by the Forest Service. So it's people out in the forest measuring the carbon and then extrapolating in a statistically significant way. And we now can tell you, and we can tell you by these different forest sections, how much carbon is embedded in each one of those forest areas. So the coast, the Klamath, the east and west sides of the Cascades, and so on. We can tell you by within those forests by ownership, public ownership and private ownership, and we can now tell you by carbon pool. And by that I mean that the carbon is either in living trees, it's in dead trees, it's in the soil and the roots, and there are a couple of other pools that are smaller. And there's a constant movement of carbon back and forth between those pools, as well as between the forest and the atmosphere. So this is the first step, is trying to identify, you know, how much is out there and where it is, but it's only the first step. We have four more steps that we think we have to go through before, you know, we're in a position where we can present findings to the legislature, and the legislature can choose to act or not on those findings. You know, we need to understand how that carbon passes back and forth from pool to pool. We need to understand how it passes from the pools to the air and back again. We need to understand how climate change, as it is, you know, gathering steam, is affecting those dynamics in the forest. And then we need to understand, yeah, what happens when humans intervene in the forest for any reason at all. They're in there for forest health improvements. They're in there to, you know, to cut saw logs. They're in there to, you know, clear out underbrush and thinnings for forest health, for whatever reasons. So we've got four steps to go here, but we are pleased with the group that has come together and with the data that we've been able to accumulate so far. The very preliminary findings on the net acquisition of carbon, you know, suggest that they could be in the range of, you know, as much as 30 million tons a year. So you think of our overall carbon budget, excluding forests, and just the movement of forest, the net movement into the forest could be as much as 50% of what our other carbon budget is. And we need to think about how we manage that. Are there ways that we can increase that, you know, while still managing for the productivity of the forest and the health of the forest? You know, are there some circumstances where we may have to cut into that? For example, if we have to intervene in the forest for forest health purposes, to thin out small trees, overgrowth that can lead to, you know, excess fire extent or intensity. Well, the net effect of taking those, you know, 3, 4, 6-inch diameter trees out of the forest is we're reducing the amount of carbon in the forest. We're reducing it for some very good reasons. You know, we should end up improving the health of the forest and the health of the forest ecosystems by doing so, and that should be a burden of proof. But it is a trade-off between net carbon accrued and how we want our forests to function. So we're pretty excited about that. Looking around the country, we don't see anybody else who's doing this kind of work. We hope in the middle of this year we'll be able to come back with most of, you know, those last four answers for you.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Have you been using the research that's coming out from other countries? I'm thinking primarily of Canada, other places, where they're studying very similar kinds of issues?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, we are doing that largely through pulling a couple of key people in from the OSU Department of Forestry, and then ODF and the U.S. Forest Service. I mean, they're really the ones that are sort of entering those data and findings into our deliberations.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Brock-Smith.
Thank you. So I'm a former county commissioner, former board member for the Association of Oregon Counties. Mm-hmm. How closely are you working with the Forest Service and the BLM? I know they just went through their resource management plan, and through their own work, the 2.5 million acres of ONC lands within Oregon show 1.2 billion board feet growth annually. Which is just adding to the carbon.
Right.
So how closely are you working with them? And then I have a follow-up question.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Representative Smith, BLM is not on the task force right now because we're mostly looking at heavily forested areas. And while BLM has, you know, significant forest holdings, you know, they also have a lot of grassland. And in some respects, that's sort of the next chapter we have to look at is those grasslands. So the primary focus within the federal agencies has been with the Forest Service. But, for example, the analysis that you see right there, that all came from the Forest Service. That's their analysis extrapolated to other public lands and to private lands as well, but very closely with the Forest Service.
Well, again, 1.2 billion board feet grown a year. So I would say that's a significant amount of timber within the 2.5 million acres of ONC lands within Oregon. But my question would be, you know, in 2015, we had wildfires in excess of 9 million acres nationally. And so when it comes to sequestered carbon and those forest and those trees that were burned up, those 9 million acres of trees that were burned up, how much of that is it possible to measure the tons of sequestered carbon loss into the atmosphere and what the impact was to greenhouse emissions because of that sequestered carbon being burned up and pumped in the atmosphere?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, that's exactly one of those data points that we are aiming this analysis at. And the answer is yes, we think that we can calculate that. And just to give you an example, there are two significant considerations here when you're trying to figure out what the carbon effect is of a forest fire. You know, its extent and its severity, and how much carbon it's leaving standing after the fire is gone. So if it's an extremely severe fire, you know, it's burning down almost everything, and there's not that much standing timber left after a really severe fire. But a fire which is not as severe, even though it may be substantially more extensive in terms of acreage burned, can end up leaving a lot of carbon still in the forest. Now, it's in the forest in the form of dead standing trees and fallen standing trees, but it's still there. And so, as I say, one of the things we need to be able to do is figure out what those flows are that occur when something significant happens to the forest, and a forest fire is obviously a significant one. You know, big fire, little fire, severe fire, you know, extensive fire. So we want to be able to tell you on a year-to-year basis so that we can all look forward and say, you know, if fire activity stayed at this same level, we'd be looking at this kind of loss of carbon. We'd be looking at this kind of retention of carbon, and be looking at that retained carbon evolving over the next 20 or 30 or 50 years into carbon that degrades and is lost to the atmosphere, or carbon that degrades and goes into the soil and is embedded in the soil. We need to understand those flows of carbon among the pools in the forest and what happens to them, particularly when there's a fire, or there's extraction, or there's thinning, or whatever.
One more follow-up, and then we're going to have to really push along.
Yeah.
Sorry. Would you agree that then managing forests with selective harvests would help mitigate wildfire and promote a healthier forest so that we keep that carbon sequestered rather than it burning up? And
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, so that's exactly the kind of question that I think the legislature ought to be asking. And we don't have those answers yet, but they are almost certainly going to be, for example, different from forest area to forest area. There will be some areas where the best thing you can do by way of management is, you know, a light hand or no hand at all. I think there will be some areas where it's going to be really important to have, you know, an active management hand. There are going to be certainly areas for the next 50 or 100 years where there's going to have to be active management, including thinning, in order to try to recover those forests to some sort of a normative state of forest health. And until we can describe what the numbers are, it's simply not possible to say which policies are appropriate to which forests, you know, in which circumstances. You do more, for example, in a wet year than a dry year. And at the end of the day, it's important for you and us both to give great deference to, you know, the experts out in the forest. But we have to figure out how to translate what they know about the forest into data and findings that, you know, a commission or a legislature can use. So that's what we're in the process of trying to do.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
And in the interest of time, I'm going to ask the committee to hold your questions until the end. We're a few slides from that point, and if we have time, that's great.
Great.
They're about 10 minutes.
Yeah. All right. So I think the last two I can work through pretty fast. This one in particular, it is sort of the co-equal responsibility of my commission, besides tracking carbon emissions and looking at carbon policies that reduce those emissions, to help prepare the state for dealing with the effects of climate change. And the long and the short of it is that neither my commission nor the state government generally, you know, has done its job in this respect. I was a part of a group back in 2010 of agency directors and staff that did an initial run through of what the state's adaptation and preparation policies ought to be, and we produced a document called a framework. But when we say it's a framework, you know, that means it has, you know, the headings, but not a lot underneath the headings. There is very little detail on what the state and state agencies ought to be doing to prepare for climate change. There are agencies that periodically sort of rise above that generalization. The State Health Authority, just in the last year, has done some really, again, good, interesting, and groundbreaking work on trying to identify where emerging health threats are going to be deriving from that are associated with climate change. ODOT has done at least some work, especially on the coast, to identify stretches of 101 that are vulnerable. But apart from anecdotal actions like that, we simply have done almost nothing as a state to prepare for climate change and its effects on people, its effects on infrastructure, its effects on health. And you have the companion this year to my report in the report from the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute at Oregon State, which is very similar to the second assessment that they did and the first assessment they did. It simply says that the impacts are closer, they are larger, and the risks are commensurately greater, you know, when we do little or nothing. I should note that there are a number of cities and counties that have taken more systematic action than the state has, but the state has not. I was hoping my commission could pick this up in 2016, but between the utility bill and the work on the Forest Service and the fact of my last item of presentation here, we simply weren't able to. So adaptation preparation is a can that just got kicked down the road another year or so. I hope that we'll be able to pick it up here in 2017, but it definitely and desperately needs to be addressed, you know, from the perspectives of people, from the perspectives of natural resources, from the perspective of infrastructure. And the last question then is, so are there better ways to do this than the way we're doing it right now? And yeah, there are a lot of better ways to do it. We're recommending one, which is captured in legislation that is being introduced, I believe, on this side by your chair and vice chair Power, and and that the commission had a hand in developing, and that the commission, you know, all of our members unanimously support going forward with. And it would do two things. It would provide a minimal staff and analytic budget for the commission. So we'd have, you know, $1 million a biennium to manage these processes, to take on more than one issue at a time, and particularly to do the kind of cost effectiveness analysis that we still don't do as a state. So we've got a long list of both emissions reduction and adaptation preparation measures we can choose from, but right now it's a Chinese menu, you know, and with no prices. So we don't really know what are the smarter things to do first and what are the things to defer on. We have a rough guess, but we don't sit down and measure it. And that's one of the things I would hope our commission would be able to pick up and do with a little bit of both financial and staff support. The other thing that, and I appreciate that you're looking at a fairly major funding hole in the budget that you have to backfill. You know, and this is not the best year to ask for money, and not that I expect there ever is a good one. So the request is on there. But the other part of the bill, you know, which I hope survives even if the funding request gets kicked to the curb, is a request to set the commission up with at least the authority to sit down with the state agencies that have a significant part of either our emissions or our adaptation preparation agendas, work out what their share with them in a collaborative way, what their share of the state's program is or ought to be, work out with them some benchmarks for measuring progress, and then get a report from them on an annual basis that would come to my commission, and we would then basically digest and process and bring to the legislature saying, here's where we're making progress, here's where we're not making progress, in each case to the extent we can identify it with the agency. Why aren't we making progress? I predict that 98% of the time it's going to be FTE and budget, but that's okay. That's information that the legislature needs as well. And then we'll have something of substance, which is a collaborative report from the agencies, not just of the commission, on what needs doing in the state and where we think the priorities ought to be. And that, Mr. Chairman, is our report.
Thank you very much. It's impressive. And is the other, in our materials, there are two items. Is the other the full report?
Correct.
Okay, so on OLIS, you can get the full report and print it out if you like.
And Mr. Chairman, I should have done this also, and I hope Dr. Moat has done so, but we also need to get you a link to the Oregon State University third assessment, climate impact assessment, and we'll do that.
I believe actually we're going to be having that as
good.
An agenda item in the very near future.
Great.
So we'll get that.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much. Are there any final questions that we can get done in 2 minutes?
I might have
Representative Breschke.
Thank you, Chair Helm, and thank you, Ms. Shipley and Mr. Let me get it.
Boy, they're clapping for you.
They're anticipating your question.
Man, there you go. Man, didn't even ask it.
Well, Mr. Duncan, there we go. Thank you. All right. Could you go to slide 5? I think it's 5 that I saw there. I counted from the front.
Okay.
Keep going.
Tell
keep
me what slide 5 going. Will you just keep
say? Going. All right. Oh, you just passed.
Okay.
Forward one more. Very good. Okay, yep. Great. So help me understand this chart just a little bit. The line that goes down, you know, like at a 45-degree angle there at the very bottom, 2050, I guess, it's like at the 15 million metric ton. Would that be good if we could reach that?
Jessica, do you want to take this?
I mean,
you take it.
Would we be excited about that if we could reach that?
Wait, we would be absolutely.
We would be
Sherman,
ecstatic.
Yes, we'd be tickled pink.
Okay, a follow-up then is, suppose Oregon could reach that. We could do something to get there, but our counterparts in Idaho, California, New Mexico, and so on, increased carbon production. You know, I see this as a, quote, a global warming problem, not an Oregon warming problem. So if we're doing and spending all this taxpayer dollar to do something and other states aren't doing it, and to extrapolate further, if Oregon's doing it, nobody in the U.S. is doing it, and neither is Canada or Mexico or China or India doing something about this, I'm just concerned that we're not going to make a dent. And if we make a dent, how much of a dent are we really making?
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Reschke?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So, you're quite right. If we do our job and nobody else does their job, we're toast. And I mean that literally, of course. But as a practical matter, all of this is to some extent a gentleman's. It's two things. It's a gentleman's agreement that, you know, if I do my part, you'll do your part, and as long as most of the parties are doing their part, you know, then we each carry each other along. And as an example, you know, we do a lot of work in collaborative relationships with California and Washington and sometimes British Columbia, and we used to say sort of early on that, you know, if those entities were able to reduce their emissions, well, they represent something like 6 or 7% of the world's GDP. Although we did have to note that if you subtracted British Columbia, Washington, and Oregon, they still represented about 6% of the world's GDP. But that's significant. If 6% of the world's GDP is the west coast of North America, and if we're delivering, and if the Northeast states that formed the REGI partnership and have an active operating cap and trade, if they're delivering as well, if the wind alley from Texas north to the Dakotas continues putting in wind generation at the same rate that they are putting in wind generation and have for the last 10 or 15 years, sort of whether they adopt any carbon goals or not, if China meets the carbon goals that they have announced, if the European Union, and you can see where I'm going with this, if the majority of states and the majority of countries in the world are stepping up to their responsibilities along with Oregon, you know, then we're in kind of a mutually reinforcing club. And in that circumstance, there's a significant, you know, opportunity for us to bring emissions down globally.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Did I keep that under 2 minutes?
I don't know. Last question, Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this goes towards the global question that Representative Reschke and transportation. So when we're talking about the global question, and we know that, and we're, you know, talking about carbon sequestration, but we know that mining of lithium for the electric battery, for the batteries, for the electric cars, of course, is a larger carbon output, is it not, than creating gasoline engines? At what point does that, are you looking into that? Is your committee looking into that? At what point does that level out?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, in all of these circumstances, there's clearly carbon, there's a carbon cost to save carbon. You know, if you're building solar panels, there's a carbon cost to build a solar panel. If you're mining and processing lithium for lithium-ion batteries, there is a carbon cost to doing that as well. And I'm not familiar with the carbon balance for lithium-ion batteries. You know, I am for solar panels and a lot of other things. And in almost all circumstances of which I'm aware, if you assume that this equipment is in operation for, you know, a year or two at least, then you cross over that carbon balance fairly quickly. But I'm happy to take a look at with Jessica that at the question of the carbon balance for lithium ion and get back to you on that question as well.
Thank you.
With that, I'll thank you both very much for your testimony and all the good work that went into the report.
I'm Chairman,
continually impressed and amazed that you do it with the resources that we give you.
Yeah, we have a model for other agencies. Yeah. Boy, that's for sure.
Right?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
At this time, I'm going to open up a public hearing for both House Bill 2295 and 2296. And I'll ask Director Beiler and Raquel Rancier to come forward first to talk about House Bill 2295. And you're in luck. Angus didn't even say the word drought, I don't think.
Not this year.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Tom Beiler. I'm the director of the Oregon Water Resources Department. Sitting on my left is Raquel Rancier, our senior policy coordinator for the department as well. And we're pleased to be here to talk to House Bill 2295, we'll start with. I did notice the word drought on the presentation slides, though, just so it wasn't completely unreferenced.
He slipped it in there.
I had the chance to, Raquel and I had the chance to meet with a number of you on both House Bill 2295 and 2296 in advance of this meeting. Apologies to Representative Holvey for not getting a chance to chat with him. We do have submitted testimony, and we'll try to keep our remarks fairly brief, but I do want to just emphasize some main points with respect to House Bill 2295. This bill is really designed to help us maintain really important core functions for the agency. And those services relate to what I'll call our water right related transactions, the processes that we go through. And I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail in a second. But also our dam safety program and the services that we provide there. And the bill achieves that or pursues that goal of maintaining those functions by doing two things. One, it proposes to repeal a sunset that's in the current law that would revert our fees related to these functions back to 2009 levels. The second thing that it does is that it proposes on average, a 15.88% increase to fees related to these program areas. So I want to first talk a little bit about the water right transactions and give you a better sense of what those are. Again, these are very important core functions for the agency, and they are actions that relate to permitting new water rights, the applications and review of those applications that we receive. They involve consideration of extensions of time for water right permit holders who are seeking additional time to develop and perfect their water use. They involve getting to a certificated level of the processing a claim for beneficial use so that one can get a water right certificate, which is the, I guess, the gold standard for any water right holder. It involves water right transfers as well. So those folks who have perfected water rights or certificated water right at times have the desire to be able to move the point of diversion or the point of appropriation, the place of use or the character of use. These are all very important functions for the agency. And for some time now, those functions and services have been supported in part by fees. Since 2009, our target has been to have about a 50-50 split between fee revenue supporting these services and general fund. And in 2009, we had those fees were for a four-year period. And again, those fees were updated in 2013. And we're back here today seeking another fee increase, again, that 15.88%, to help maintain our service levels and keeping up with the costs associated with increased inflation around services and supplies, our responsibilities to keep up with our benefits, including PERS, our responsibilities in terms of keeping up with cost of living expenses associated with this. The way this is designed is that it would last for 4 years, so that this would keep us at our current service level for the next 4 years with these programs. In addition, with dam safety, These functions are, we have engineers who, two engineers right now, who provide important functions in terms of reviewing the technical specifications associated with the construction of new reservoirs and the structures that hold water. And as well, they do the important function of inspecting and evaluating the physical integrity of structures around the state. Now, not all structures are subject to this review. This is for reservoirs that are 10 feet tall or over, or hold more than 3 million gallons, I believe, which is 9.2 acre feet. Those structures, and there are 900 of them around the state, are the ones that our two staff are responsible for inspecting and reviewing over time. What this fee increase will allow us to do is to have more stability in our staffing, and would help us to be able to have make permanent one of those two positions that I was referring to. We've been working on this concept with our stakeholders. We have a long tradition of working with our stakeholders on these fee-related issues. And for the last year, have been gathering our key stakeholders together, talking about this idea. And I know you'll hear from a number of them as part of the hearing today. But they have been involved and provide a lot of input in the bill that you see before you today. So I'll pause there, Representative or Chair Helm, and see if there are any questions.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do I have this right, Mr. Director, that the increase is actually 4% a year over 4 years, a fraction less? Is that what you mean by over 4 years? 15.88% divided by four is roughly 4%.
Yeah. Chair Helm, Representative Bentz, the analysis that we did was tied to the DAS projected increases over time. And for the next two biennium, each biennium was projected to be about 10%. And so we talked with our stakeholders, do we have a 10% in the first biennium and 10% in the next biennium? There are different ways we could have approached this. Where we landed was this 15.88%, which was our a way to be able to meet that expected increase, taking a slightly different approach. So, in other words, by taking that approach, we overachieve, if you will, the first biennium and underachieve the second.
Follow up. Thank you. It would be helpful if we could go back and look at the amount of the increase in 2009, because it was substantial, because I think it was that at that point that there was a shift away from pretty much general fund over to half and half. That's my vague recollection. But it would be interesting to see that. Am I correct in assuming that this increase anticipates a similar increase on the state's side of the half, or is the state's half shrinking and the private party's share increasing?
Mm-hmm. Chair Helm, Representative Bentz, there have been fees for some time on these programs. Historically, prior to 2009, the ballpark range of what it covered relative to the general fund was more in the 25% to 35% range, but we can certainly pull together more information on that. So in 2009, the ratio between fees and general fund did shift, and fees covered more as a result. And I'm sorry, on the second question that you had, our intent on the general fund is to, this is tied to what we are expecting in terms of general fund cost of living increases as well. So those proportional increases should be roughly the same. What we can't control is how many applications we receive relative to these different water-related transactions. Yeah. And so the variability really happens on the fee level, not on the general fund level. And sometimes we don't achieve that 50% target on the fee level because we didn't receive as many applications for these different processes and as we expected.
Mr. Chair, the final question.
Follow up.
Thank you. It seems to me there is a suggestion that the sunset go away, but in fact it really kind of doesn't, because you only have gone out 4 years. So we can anticipate you will be back in 4 years, absent some really strange series of events, even without the sunset.
Chair Helm, Representative Bentz, that's the formula we seem to be in right now in terms of extending for 4 years and then revisiting this issue. Our fees are, by and large, statutory-based, and so in order to be able to keep up with those cost of living increases, we'll need to revisit those questions.
Thank you.
Representative Brock-Smith.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Over the past several years, there's been an increasing number of litigation with regards to your department's water rights and so forth. Where does the funds come from for your department's time to deal with that litigation?
Chair Helm, Representative Brock-Smith. We are budgeted for legal expenses at the beginning of each biennium based on cooperation between DAS and the governor's office and DOJ. We don't always find ourselves there are times when litigation expenses can be more than what we're budgeted. And in those cases, we have two options. Any agency would have two options under those scenarios. One would be to try to make up for the difference by finding savings within our existing budget over the course of the biennium. The other would be to ask the emergency board to provide additional resources to cover those expenses.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. And thank you both for visiting with me last week. I did a little more research since you were in my office, and Rep. Bentz was referencing the increases in 09 that were in Senate Bill 788, I think was the one. And those were extensive across the board fee increases. And he made some promises, or at least the department made some promises on increased service and so forth, and just monitoring and so forth. I wondered how all that actually played out in reality, as well as do all those increases go away and these are to supplement the sunsets, or are we talking about additional increases on top of those that were instituted back in 09?
Chair Helm, Representative Johnson, Vice Chair Johnson. I'm not familiar with what the department promised or what goals we set for ourselves back at that time. We can take a look at that and certainly report back to the committee on that. My understanding of the fees and how they're set up is that this increase would be additive to the existing fees that we have now. So that 15.88% would be on top of the 2009 and the 2013 increases.
Follow up. So these additional fees are primarily maintenance of effort, or again, are we saying we're going to have better performance out of the department or out of the resources board as a result of this?
Yeah, Chair Helm and Vice Chair Johnson, I can tell you that we always strive to improve our performance. That's part of our culture and who we are and what we try to do. The way this fee increase is designed is to maintain our current services. So we aren't asking for new positions. We aren't augmenting our resources in terms of our person power. But we're always looking for opportunities to improve how we go about our business to improve services.
Okay. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really have two kinds of questions. One is have you explored a different way of doing this? I recognize there are political problems with fees, but I wonder if you've explored a different way of managing the fee problem, the fee issue, as costs change over time. That's the first question. The second one is, what happens if a bill like this doesn't pass? What's the effect of that, not just on your department, but on our capacity to manage this area that you're responsible for?
Chair Helm, Representative Barnhart, in terms of your first question, the department over the past 10 years or so has taken a hard look at how it's funded. And in part because the agency is primarily general funded. And during the 2000s, there were steep reductions to the agency's budget. And I think which may have partially informed some of the decisions around the 2009 and 2013 fee increases, to be honest. So that's a struggle, and it's not unique to the Water Resources Department. Many agencies really struggle to how to support the services. I don't have answers for you today on the best way to go about it, but we are definitely open to further exploring ideas on where we can find a more sustainable path for ourselves. And because we've had problems and struggles just being on the general fund, let alone the fee issues over time. And I have to apologize, your second question.
What happens if a bill like this doesn't pass?
Yes, thank you.
What to the department, and then more importantly, to the function that the department performs on behalf of the state of Oregon and the people of Oregon?
Yes. If the bill doesn't pass, our fee revenue would revert back to 2009 levels. And over the next 4 years, in the next 2 years, we would have a reduction of about 2.5 FTE, and the following biennium about 3 FTE. That's a reduction in our services. I can't tell you exactly how that would play out with respect to what decisions we would make on those different programs, but it would be an overall reduction in services. How that could play out for the public is that there would be delay in timing of services. That it might take longer to get a transfer. It might take longer to get a water right extension. It might mean that we don't. And from the public standpoint, these folks are business people. They're farmers. They're municipalities. They're trying to make decisions based on their business needs. And I think that the potential impact would be that it would they would have to plan for longer lines and longer timelines to get responses from the department on these issues associated with their water needs.
Follow up. Yeah. So this could slow down the economy, reduce job growth, restrict the capacity of people to transfer property from one person to another, those kind of things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, it certainly at a water user scale could have an impact.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ruski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Beiler and Ms. Ranzier, for coming to my office and also for coming today. I'm going to piggyback on Representative Ben's question about the cost being roughly, it's a little bit less than 4% per year. And I heard you mention inflation as being one of the drivers, but I can't find inflation being anywhere close to 4% a year since 2013 or even since 2009. And then Rep. Barnhart here called it a fee problem. I want to know what the cost of the driver is this, because I don't think it's acceptable to keep coming back 4 years after 4 years asking for higher and higher fees to maintain current service levels, or bad things happen to the people you're supposed to serve.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Ruski, the percentage of inflation for services and supplies is a relatively small proportion of what's driving the increase. The bigger elements are the salary and benefit packages, which are tied to the contract that we have with the union. We are a union agency. And the other bigger cost is related to the obligation to pay the PERS benefits over time, which is, as you know, spiking in recent years.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Representative Brock-Smith.
I had a question, and then you hit me with the union and the COLA increases, and I went. You know, coming as a former county commissioner, I have good people that have worked in Curry County since, and they haven't seen a cost of living since 2009. And so when we have environmental for-profit, nonprofit agencies that are keeping us from being able to utilize our resources, plus then adding litigation costs to your departments that you have to pay, and those are tax dollars that are having to pay it, and they're driven by unions, I don't have any sympathy for a lot of things. Sorry. I appreciate the minutes.
That was a great question.
My question is, since 2009, how many new regulations have been added to your plate and to your department's plate that you have to to our regulations to our citizens that you have to enforce, that you have to utilize your time, your staff's time and effort to be responsible for.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brocksmith, it's with great confidence that I can tell you I can't answer that question sitting here today. We can take a look, and we can take a look at that and get a sense of the water legislation that that passed over that time period.
Because you know, I mean, it goes to Representative Barnhart's question. I understand that you know there could be some commerce and situations and so forth, but if by any means that we have to go back to 09 levels. I'm sure we can roll back some regulations because we were doing just fine back then, too. So so we can stay afloat, possibly.
Mr. Chair, if I may on that, we'll take a closer look at this. But relative to these programs that we're talking about, I don't know that there's been a whole lot of changes. We'll take a closer look more specifically to these water right-related transactions because I do want to make a distinction. These are either people seeking new water rights or seeking changes to their water rights, or we're talking about dam safety, and which is a slightly different arena than the regulation and distribution of water.
Thank you.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Chair. And I just want to share with everyone who wasn't on the Water Resource Commission 20 years ago as I was, when we had 8,000, I think we had a backlog of 8,000 water rights, transfers, everything else. And I may be off 1,000 or two, but not very, very far. And it took moving heaven and earth to try to catch up. I'm not enthused about finding ourselves in that position again. That, and then to speak to Representative Barnhart's point, the impact on the economy was major because those transfers were so important as to every aspect of what we do with water. And we had all kinds of games being played trying to leapfrog over other folks to get ahead of them. I don't think anyone was actually bribed, but it was one of those situations which was really grim. And so these kinds of fees are terrifically important if we're going to maintain the evolution, if you will, of the management of our water. So I don't want to throw that out because I was there, and I know what happens if you don't keep up. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Just a question.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Tom, you mentioned PERS, which I appreciated. If, in fact, the legislature should make progress on mitigating some of the increase of the PERS upon your budget, would you be able to submit a revised request for a fee increase segment? Delineate that portion that's driven by PERS increases and that's not.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Johnson, and, you know, given that that was one of the cost drivers associated with this, we certainly would take a look at it and be willing to consider how we would make that adjustment.
Great, thank you.
Thank you both very much. I'm going to invite the folks that want to testify on this bill up. April Snell, Jeff Stone, and Marianne Nash, come on up. Folks, while they're getting up to the podium here, I'm going to carry over the public hearing on 2296 till Wednesday so that we have enough time for everybody to testify on this bill, 2295, today. So we'll put it on that schedule for Wednesday. And I'll try to get to it as soon as I can in the agenda on Wednesday. Go right ahead.
Okay. Chair Helm, Vice Chair Power, Vice Chair Johnson, members of the committee. I'm April Snell, Executive Director with the Oregon Water Resources Congress. We represent irrigated agriculture, including irrigation districts and other entities throughout Oregon. Our members collectively deliver to one-third of all the irrigated land in the state. The remainder of that irrigated land is served by private farmers or served by, in many places, rainfall. But for our members, the work of the Water Resources Department that you just heard is extremely important. They have a variety of transactions that they do, and those positions that process them in a timely fashion are essential to them being able to continue what they do and manage water responsibly. This is the third time that I have engaged in the transactions fees, and I will say every time it comes up, I think, boy, already? It just seems like we just did that. And I would really wish that we could come up with a way to not have to do that so frequently. But you heard a little bit from the department, and just to give you a little bit more background from a water user perspective, this arrangement, so to speak, has predated my time with OWRC, where there's generally a 50-50 split, where the positions that do those various transactions are roughly 50% funded by the fee that a water user sends in and 50% funded by general fund. We've had a couple good years, and now we're back into what's been, I think, the typical economic environment that impacts Water Resources Department and the natural resources agencies disproportionately more than any other sector. Every time there's a budget cut, their general fund gets cut more than any other sector. And so while we are very much supportive of these transaction fees, and as much it is as difficult for our members to understand why they need to pay more to cover a PERS burden, they also recognize that if the fees don't go forward and go back to the 2009 levels, people will get laid off and everything will go much slower, and we don't want that to happen. However, there are some other issues out there that are concerning to our members, and one is that the department's budget needs to have adequate general fund, and that 50-50 split needs to be maintained. Without that, then we're just disproportionately putting more of the burden on water users who are increasingly being burdened with a variety of fees. The other is there are other bills out there that could further impact our members, including a potential new fee on annual water rights, and we're very much open to discussing how we come up with a sustainable way to fund the water resources department, but we need to make sure that any such fees are equitable in providing services, and moreover, that any new fees don't simply lead to the department's budget being cut by that same amount. We want to improve water management in this state, not see it go back to the days where Representative Bence was referring to. We can't have that. So with that, I will pause there to give more time to my colleagues and really appreciate this committee's time in looking at these important issues.
Chair Helm, Vice Chairs Johnson and Power, members of the committee, I'm Jeff Stone. I serve as the Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Nurseries. The nursery industry is your second largest sector of ag, over $894 million now. Half goes east of the Mississippi of our plant products, 75% out of the state, and so we're a big economic engine. This particular bill is important to us because water transfers are a big part of how we do business. And so appreciate your full consideration of this bill and the 50-50 split, because we felt that that was equitable back in 2009, as we do today. We also want to make sure that the department is prioritizing in its core mission. And so how we construct their budget is as important in terms of what they do and how they do it versus how they are funded. So we look at both sides of those coins. I'm sure you're sick of having this come back to you. I'm sick of having my lobbyists sing TLC's Don't Chasing Waterfalls every time I talk about water. But that's my burden, not yours. But the cumulative impact on fees is also something to keep in mind as you go through this legislative session. The nursery industry raised fees on itself last year for its nursery program. We did that knowingly. But my members, much like April's, looks at a cumulative factor every session about how it costs to do business in this state. So we want a functional natural resource agency. We want to have you be aware of the cumulative impacts of these, and we will weigh in fully when this matter goes to the Ways and Means Committee. But we want to make sure that we expressed our opinions with you this afternoon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, and Vice Chair Powers, my name is Marianne Nash, here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation.
As you all are aware, water is the lifeblood for Oregon's farmers and ranchers, and it's essential for the Oregon agricultural economy. Agriculture generally contributes an estimated $50 billion to the state's economy, and it's the state's second largest economic driver. Given the importance of water to all of our 220-plus commodities, Oregon Farm Bureau has been actively engaged in the department's budget and management for the last several decades. The timely processing of applications, transfers, and other transactions is critical to the success of our industry and to my members. However, given that farmers are largely price takers who sell on an international market, they are very sensitive to minimizing the need for cost increases. As such, we are concerned about the cost impact of increasing the transaction fee, particularly if the proposed legislation that would charge water users for water rights moves forward. We also want to make sure that the department continues to uphold the 50-50 split agreement for allocation of fees that was negotiated several sessions ago. So we can only remain neutral in this bill moving forward if the water users are not subject to significant additional cost this session, and if the department is actually given its 50-50 split in the general and through the general fund. So with that, I will take any questions you have. Thank you.
One question, Representative Bentz.
Just, I'm surprised no one mentioned the dam safety piece, given the disaster in Oroville that we're watching on the news. 200,000 people evacuated. So that this funds that. So that's a big deal. And so just saying, as you all kind of said, I think this is an important bill. And I agree with what you said about the 50-50 and about the other costs being critically important. But that dam safety piece is huge.
I'm going to thank you so that we can get the rest of the folks' testimony today.
Thank you.
We will be having, I think, more hearings on this bill. So
thanks.
Don't fear that you won't get to have a second chance. We'll go to Tracy Rutten, Mark Landauer, and then our last panel will be Claire Clock, Angela Crowley Cook, and Tom Wolf.
Good afternoon, Chair Helm, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association. Our members, along with the League of Oregon Cities, we are responsible for serving 88% of the state's population with municipal water. That represents approximately 3.3 million people. We're supportive of the proposed fee increase to maintain the current service level in the transaction section of the department. Municipal suppliers understand and utilize the fee-for-service model, so we too recognize the cost of doing business and the challenges that come with providing those services. But our support comes with the understanding that those fees are tied directly to the services provided and not to supplement some other programmatic areas just simply to fill gaps. Also, we assume and expect that the increased fees will not be a justification to sweep other general fund monies from the department, thereby diluting the soup, if you will. We are more than willing to pay our fair share for the services provided by the department. However, that willingness is dependent on the department being accountable in ensuring that the fees are being used efficiently, reducing the backlogs, as Representative Bentz mentioned, and I might add they've done a very good job in doing so, but there is still more work to be done, and getting the permits and transfers out of the door as quickly as possible. In recent years, the department's budget, as has been mentioned, has been significantly increased for grant and loan programs, and this may create the appearance that the department is adequately staffed. I would submit that that's not the case. For the most part, we're supportive of these programs, but these investments should not give you the illusion, again, that the department is adequately staffed and doing all the necessary work that needs to be done. So in conclusion, we remain supportive of this. We'll certainly express that before the Ways and Means Committee. They're doing a pretty good job, but again, there's still more work to be done.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, Tracy Rutten with League of Oregon Cities, here today on behalf of our 241 cities, many of which provide drinking water to their citizens. I don't think I need to reiterate much of what's already been said. I would agree with what Mr. Landauer indicated. There's been significant additional investments in the department in past years. We've been encouraged by those and supportive of those as well. But again, their funding for their core services, what we would call their core services, is something that we are critically aware of and that we find of significant importance to our members as they try and get transactions processed through the department in a timely fashion. You know, we've watched with concern as there have been various news stories, I guess the newsworthy stories of our times, whether it's the drought of 2015, whether it's the groundwater article that ran in the Oregonian, now I would say whether it's Oroville and the dam safety issue, and we continue to see the department having to react to kind of these fires as they go along, and we understand the challenges that they face. We want to make sure that their core functions continue to be fully funded. It's challenging for us as the fee payers because I know that this doesn't probably get us to fully funded, but we're certainly terrified of the alternative, which is for them to cut additional staff in this department area. For us, and I think it was asked by Representative Barnhart, what does this mean if we do not fund this going forward? For us, it exposes us to potential litigation, which is a huge concern for us and something that we've experienced in previous years. As we wait for certain transactions to be processed, and it takes a considerable amount of time. Our communities need to make investments regardless of how long that transaction process takes. We can't simply tell our citizens, you know, sorry, there's not enough drinking water right now. We're aware that land use requires us to plan 20 years in advance, but and we know that we've got infrastructure investments we need to make. Those things have to happen regardless of whether we've got a transaction in hand. So it makes it very challenging for us in terms of our certainty going forward on really critical investments in ensuring water supply for the future. And I believe it was Mr. Stone that indicated the transfer process. And that really is critical. There is, as many of you know, no new water in Oregon or not a lot of water to be allocated in the times that we need it the most. So the ability to move water around, which is also known as a transfer, is really important going forward and something that we want to make sure the department's able to do in a timely fashion. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
And I thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Like I said, we'll have another chance to talk about
it. Great.
Claire Clock, Angela Crowley Cook, and Tom Wolf. And I've now caused my committee to stay overtime, so I would appreciate as concise a testimony as you can provide. Go ahead, Claire.
Chair Helm and members of the committee, my name is Claire Clock, a retired farmer and part-time conservation specialist from Multnomah County, Corbett, Oregon. And I came here to talk about each of the bills. And in the course of the conversation this afternoon, it's an overarching problem. And the one thing that I do know is I found out in my business is that I have to know what the inventory is to make sure that I can deliver what I promised to my customers. I had to go out and I had to take a survey and see how many berries I had in the field and then ascertain if I could deliver, because if I didn't deliver them to my customers, then I would be in big trouble. Now, the problem is that Oregon does not know how much water we have. And that's one of the things that we need to do. We need to, in all the bills here, that's this one and both of these and the ones that are coming up, we need to find out what our inventory. We cannot manage a resource unless we know what the inventory is. There's amazing conservation measures that are occurring, but they need to increase. So this is a multifaceted type of a problem. So anyway, that was the thing. And so when you talk about the water rights that we have now, how can we be giving more water rights out and utilizing our water rights capacity when we don't know what we have already? So loss of groundwater levels and that type of thing. I'll probably comment later, but this is, a real complex issue that will all of us are going to have to study a little bit more to see where it goes. But the Water Resource Department does need the adequate staffing to take care of these particular problems, as you heard in some of the testimony before. Thank you.
Chair Hill, members of the committee, Angela Crowley-Cook with Oregon Environmental Council. Oregon Environmental Council supports House Bill 2295 for many of the reasons you've previously heard, so I'll be short. It's critical to, in order to balance the use of our water and maintain sufficient river flows for fish and wildlife, drinking water for growing communities, and to drive the state's economy, we really need the Water Resources Department to have the resources and capacity to fulfill many of the things you heard previously, like water right transactions especially. So we support.
Chair Helm, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Power, for the record, my name is, and committee members, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, here to represent the 3,200 members here in Oregon and 155,000 across the nation. And I've already sent in written testimony that is shown up electronically, so I'm not going to repeat that. What I am going to say is people tend to paint all conservation groups the same, and they're not. Our group very seldom sues. Our group does a lot of cooperative. Right now we have both volunteers and staff members working with farmers and landowners all across the state, trying to help them deal with the issues they have to face. And one of those, of course, is how do we get sufficient water both for farming and for fish? And we're working hard on that. And we're here, I'm here today to support HB 2295 because, speaking on a fish level, it's important to do this bill because, frankly, in-stream flow is one of the constants facing the fish world that is most problematic and one needs to be able to deal with. And the Water Resources Department, besides all the what they do for farmers and other water users, provides a great benefit to those of us who love to go out and fish and in an industry that provides $1 billion a year to Oregon's economy, fishing does. And those are 2009 figures, so it's probably gone up quite a bit since then. So I'm here to represent a conservation group that doesn't sue, that really wants this bill to pass, that wants Water Resources Department to have sufficient funding to work with the other stakeholders, water users, so that we can make sure that they're not getting overcharged and make sure so the future of water in the state, whether it's abundant like this year or in drought situations like will probably happen again, we have enough for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming today. I appreciate your testimony. And with that committee, I'm going to adjourn the House Energy and Environment Committee on committee on.